Okay, so I will talk about the calculation we have been doing about this plane sphere geometry for 1 year now. And this work was done in collaboration with Ines, Astrid Lambrecht, Serge Renault from Paris, Laboratoire Castellet, Bruxelles. I will also briefly discuss related work we have done in collaboration with Diego, which is here, and he already discussed some of this related work, and also with Robson Rodriguez from Rio. So this is the outline of the talk. I will first give an introduction of why we are interested in this plane sphere geometry, and then a brief discussion of this scattering approach, and then we go to the plane sphere. Okay, so our main motivation is related to the fact that the most precise experiments that measure the Casimir force use for some experimental reasons this plane sphere geometry instead of the parallel plates setup, right? And usually the comparison between theory and experiment is made with the help of this proximity force, or also known as Derriaghen approximation. Well, you probably know that the idea is that if the surface is nearly plane, right? If the radius of curvature is very large, you can relate this plane sphere case to the plane case by taking the local distance, right? And so in the experiments, this the ratio between the separation distance and the radius is really very small, so the PFA is probably a good approximation. So L over R is of the order of 10 to the minus 3, or a little bit larger than this. But in any case, it's important to know how accurate the PFA is, because if there are some experiments that claim a very large precision, a very large accuracy, so it's important to have access to this in order to really see if the PFA is correction is sufficiently small in this for these values of L over R employed in the experiment. So this question was addressed also from the experimental point of view by DECA group, and what they did was to measure the Casimir force with different radius using different spheres with different radius, and but they found no correction in the range of radius they explored, given the accuracy of their experiment. There is also other experiments with curved geometries, like this proposed experiment by Onofio group with plane and a cylinder. And there is also an experiment which is about 10 years ago with crossed cylinders, right? So there are many experiments with curved geometries.
Crossed cylinders,
yes. That was 10 years ago. Yeah. It was in Sweden, right? That was
Sweden.
Yeah.
Swedish guy.
Yes. Two curved surfaces, cylindrical surfaces. We're not really cylinders in the fact that it's a cylinder, but just two surfaces that have a curvature in one direction and not in the other. And they used it in
layers.
Yeah, also these cylinder planes, not a cylinder, but a cylindrical lens.
Right, and also the sphere plane in some cases are just
sphere. Yeah, but also here. I think Amaros didn't use a ball, but also only lens, right?
Okay. So there is another issue related to geometry in this problem of comparing theory and experiment, is the problem of roughness. I mean, when we develop this theory for parallel plates, we assume that the surfaces are perfectly plane, but in real life they are not. They are rough, right? And especially for short separation distances, this effect can provide a significant correction, especially if the surface is not very smooth, right? Depends on the quality of the surface, of course. And so I will also discuss that later. So here we have to treat instead of a plane, surface profile. Okay. What are the ingredients we need in order to have something relevant to say about the theory experiment comparison? We need, this looks kind of obvious, but maybe it's not so obvious, so I will discuss why it is important to consider the real electromagnetic field instead of scalar field models. And a related point is the fact that the experiments are made in a separation distance such that the finite conductivity of the metals is very important. It's not just a small correction, it's a large correction to the perfect reflecting case. So let's first discuss this electromagnetic thing. I mean, I just want to say that when we go from scalar to electromagnetic, one might think very naively that this is just a factor of two from polarization, but this is not true. This is true for the Casimir calculation in 48 for parallel perfect reflecting planes. But it's not true in general for the parallel geometry, for the plane geometry. Let's take, for instance, a single plate, perfect reflector, like in Casimir calculation, but moving, okay? In this case, there is a Casimir dissipative force which was calculated, in one-dimensional case, this was first calculated by a professor.
I don't really claim the credit.
But yeah, with a paper with Davis, but in the 70s, if I remember well. So Professor Fulling calculated
this. I'm not
sure
that they even talked about the force. Mm-hmm. I'm more interested in just the radiation coming.
In the radiation, okay. Yeah.
Somewhere along the line, mm-hmm. Somebody.
Okay. Okay, but I think you calculated the stress tensor and everything too. And
this was radiation created by the moon.
Yeah, this is what they call dynamical Casimir effect. Now, at that time, it was not called like this, but now they call it dynamical Casimir effect.
Because everything is Casimir.
Yeah. Okay. So what happened is that there is this radiation emission, and as a consequence, there is a dissipative force on the mirror and. Ford and Wilenki calculated this for a scalar vacuum field model in 82. I mean, this is a non-relativistic limit, whereas Professor Fulling's calculation is general, but it's in 1 plus 1. Here it's 3 plus 1, right? So it must be proportional to the surface, to the area of the plate, and it's proportional to H bar. And it must, since we are doing a non-relativistic limit, this is some linear, must be proportional to some derivative of the velocity, cannot be proportional to the velocity, of course, by Lorentz invariance. It must be some even derivative of the velocity to be a dissipative force. And by dimensional analysis only, we can infer that it must be the fourth derivative. Okay, and it's the only way to have the proper dimension. And then the only way to have the proper dimension is to have the c to the power 4. And this is already very small, right, because there is a c to the power 4 here. But moreover, what is left to calculate is just the prefactor. And the prefactor is also miserably small, right? So kind of funny, right? So, I have calculated for the electromagnetic case a long time ago. And it's 12 times larger. But, this is not enough to make this effect big enough to be measurable, of course. But what I want to point out is just that this is not a factor of two. Despite of the fact that I am considering a plane with a perfect reflecting Baldwin condition, but despite of this, it's not a factor of two. So this is important to stress. So it's not a trivial transition from scalar to electromagnetic. When we have some direction of translational symmetry, sometimes we can decompose the electromagnetic problem into two independent scalar problems. This is the case here. And this is the case in many other configurations, but this is certainly not the case for the plane sphere, right? We don't have a direction of translational symmetry, so it's not possible to just connect the electromagnetic case to two independent scalar field model case.
Excuse me, that there is not this factor of two in the decomposition. I mean, this
okay, maybe you said it, but it has nothing to do with dynamics, right? I mean, it's just the property of the symmetry.
Well, I mean, for the Casimir case, it's just a factor of two. But, well.
No, what I'm saying is that,
for
that
static,
you don't have this lag for a sphere, so it's a property of the static configuration. It has nothing to do with the dynamics. If the surface is moving or not, doesn't.
Oh, yeah, it's not. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, sure. Yes, it's. I mean, usually, what I want to say is that usually it's not a factor of two in any case, either in the static or dynamic. Or in some few cases, by chance, like in the Casimir calculation of 48, it's a factor of two. But yeah, in the static case, yeah, sure, yeah, I agree.
What about in the static case for a single plate, as you
were? No.
Or two? Or no?
Yeah, then I mean, we have to define what we are calculating. If you think about the stress tensor, I don't know, I don't remember if the stress tensor can be just, but okay. But then, of course, if the plate is static, the net force is zero. There is only a fluctuating force in this case. But the fluctuating force is not equal for TM and TE in this case, so it's not a factor.
Now, the electromagnetic stress tensor can't be written simply in terms of Dirichlet and Neumann scalar stress tensors, even when you have a nice decomposition of TL and TM.
Okay. So, but here for the spherical case, it's even worse, right? Because, I mean, the kind of physics we have, especially for small spheres, is completely different in the electromagnetic and in the scalar case. And the reason is that there is no West wave scattering in the electromagnetic case because of charge conservation, right? So we have a completely different physical, different power laws, different everything. Okay. So now I will discuss why it is important to discuss real materials. Okay. So one reason, I mean, I think from a more theoretical point of view, is that if you only take this is the Casimir energy as a function of separation distance calculated for the plasma model for metallic emission. And omega p is the plasma frequency, and lambda p? Two metallic parallel plates described by the plasma plasma model with plasma frequency omega p and lambda p. Typically, it's for gold, which is the metal used in the experiments, is 137 nanometers. So this is the red line is the Casimir result for perfect reflectors, and the black line is the exact result within the plasma model, as obtained from Lifshitz theory, and the blue line is the van der Waals regime, the non-retarded regime, right? So this is, it's interesting, it's important to realize that if you only have this model of perfect reflectivity, we can never understand the connection between Casimir and van der Waals, right?
Funny thing is, an experiment, it's Nyboff free.
What?
It's Nyboff free.
Yeah.
It's a flat line with slope 3.7. Mm-hmm.
The blue, you said the blue line is van der Waals.
So the blue line is proportional to omega p, right? Which is reasonable. I mean, because omega p is the coupling constant, right? But what is somehow could be unexpected is why, I mean, in the long distance range, we have something which is universally independent of this coupling parameter.
I don't know if this is important or not.
Okay.
We've been having some conversations about the exact form of the Lipschitz-Chelyushinsky expression, and it's very clear that at the lower right hand end, the southeast corner of your graph there, it should be going over to an inverse square if you recognize finite temperature. So these are all in zero temperature results.
Ah, this is a zero temperature.
And that is kind of a logical inversion here, because that red line can't be calculated at zero temperature and get the same answer as what the real formula is.
The red line is the Casimir 48. The red line is for zero temperature. Everything here is for zero temperature. The black line was also calculated for zero temperature from the
right. This is 1 micron, right? With the last one.
Yeah.
Yeah. One micron temperature corrections are still not very important.
This is an interesting question. It depends on the material.
Like
for water, it's always important.
Mm-hmm. You know, for water, it's not.
We're just thinking about what it means for other materials.
Because
you're down to actually one or two Matsubara frequencies at this stage.
In the general case, you can make a full calculation including temperature, and you have basically three regimes. The first one where you have a dependence like one over L to the second, to the two, is the plasma regime.
Yeah.
Then you have a change in distance between the plasma wavelength and the thermal wavelength,
right,
where you have L to the third. Mm-hmm. And again, a change in the power law,
yeah,
which is the thermal regime.
Yeah, and that's I'm suggesting it's probably happening at the right now.
It depends where you set your plasma your thermal wavelength.
Yeah. It depends what temperature you're going to calculate.
Yeah, exactly.
The temperature is 7.6 microns.
But the unfortunate thing is an experiment, as mentioned, neither of these three possibilities is realized if you believe in the Decker experiment. But it's just a flat line with slope, with power 3.7. So none of this is correct.
Yeah, okay. Actually, there is a paper, there is a paper by my collaborators.
I mean, you don't see that crossover from 4 to 3.
That's fine. But the value, they obtain the absolute value of the force?
No,
is
now
reasonably close to the model, although the slope is not.
Yeah, the slope is not.
But, I mean, the values are more or less okay. So in that sense, the theory is not completely wrong.
Yeah.
I mean, isn't it in some sense funny that you get the wrong slope, but you get almost the right numbers?
At the right place.
At the right place, yeah. So.
But the theory doesn't predict a given slope, except in some limited cases.
Well, but the limited cases were in the order. I mean, if a theory predicts a slope of 4 at 1 micron, this could be excluded as the slope of 2 at, 20 nanometers or?
Okay, can I understand why we're talking about slopes all the time? I mean, the data is measured as a function of distance, and we can do the calculation as a function of distance. So we can just put the two on top of each other and see whether they fit or not. We don't have to go into discussion about slopes.
But until you want to compare with theory.
No, but he's comparing with theory.
You can calculate the theory and calculate the data, and measure the data, and pull them and see if they match or not without going into any slope.
But then I have a problem, right? I mean, how can the slope be different and you still say the dimension theory? I mean, that's a contradiction.
It's also a prediction.
It's a crossover.
Oh, but, I mean, I understood it's a straight
line. Yeah, but it's not really a crossover.
See, well, what is a straight line in an experiment? I mean, a straight line in an experiment is not.
Well, how many separate?
I mean,
I think I would like to discuss to come back to this. My only point here is to show that we have a very large difference between the plasma, the exact plasma result and the Casimir result the experimental range is around this region here. So it's not a small correction. And it's a region where retardation is important because we are very far from the green line. The green line is for the unretarded case, but just taking the contribution of the surface plasmons. No need to quantify the field here for this green line. So the experiments are in between, right? So it's very important to have this finite conductivity model in order to say something about the experiments. It's not a small correction. I think this plot, which is I took from this nice paper. This paper is very interesting because it was very important, I think, in the history of this, because for the first time they discussed the limitations of the plasma model, how you have to modify the plasma model in order to have a more accurate theory, especially at short distances, large frequencies, where you have interband transitions, right, which are not taken into account by the plasma model. So, okay. So I think, we know that non-trivial geometries can be taken into account with finite conductivity by this proximity force approximation, the Dirac, where I have already discussed this. There is another approach which is very popular, I think you probably know very well, which is, I think, was introduced by Hamaker a long time ago in the 30s, which is to make a pairwise summation of the Van der which this is approach is more used, it's more popular for AFM community and people who work in the non-retarded regime, but it has also been used in the retarded case. So the idea is that you take the pairwise interaction, you integrate over it for these two bodies. The problem is that this Van der Waals or Casimir powder is not additive, I mean, because you don't have prescribed charges, but they are induced by the other bodies, so this is not additive. And if I do this with planes, parallel planes, I don't find the right result, except if the medium is rarefied. But if it's not, I don't find the right. There is a big difference. There is a big correction factor. So what people do, I mean, which is somehow kind of arbitrary, is to assume that this correction factor does not depend on geometry. But this is, of course, it's completely, it's not very reliable, I would say. So if you do this, then you use the same correction factor for any geometry, and then we find something which can only be trusted in the PFA limit. I mean, in fact, this kind of approach gives the same result as the PFA if the surface is nearly flat, which is reasonable because you are using the correction factor calculated for the plane case. So we need something better than this, right? So there are numerical, one of the first approaches to deal with non-trivial geometries was this word line by Gies and collaborators, but there is no electromagnetic implementation so far. Another approach which seems to be very promising, which is also heavily numerical, is this approach by Ioannopoulos' group. And so far, I think they only can treat problems with some directional translational symmetry, so they are not able to treat the plane sphere case, but probably they will be able soon, I think, as soon as they have better computers or a better improved program. But in any case, I believe that in problems where we have some symmetry, it's nice to have a semi-analytical result to play with and to understand better the physics involved. So there are many, recently there has been a lot of interesting papers on this. This is a paper from the 70s, which I think is the first to try to have some scattering approach for non-trivial geometries, Balian and Duplantier. And we have done some work with non-planar scatterers. I will discuss this in a minute. And we have heard the talks by Kenneth Clich and also by Thorsten Emig. And there are other interesting papers, I think, that have you have deal with this. Okay, I want this. I will start with Lifshitz formula. Okay, the Casimir energy written in terms of the reflection coefficients for each plate. Actually, Lifshitz himself did not write this equation as it is here. I think the first one was Professor Katz, right? If I am not wrong. So it's not only a question of rewriting the expression, but I think Professor Katz also gave a kind of new insight into this, the meaning of this formula. So the meaning of this formula is that the normal modes of this kind of cavity here inside are defined by this kind of equation. I mean, when we have a round trip loop, I have one reflection in each plate and a round trip phase propagation, I have to reproduce the same cube. Now from this, we can derive this formula, okay? Of course, this derivation, it's nice from a physical point of view, I think, but it's not as general as the formula is believed to be, actually. This Lifshitz formula, as written as Professor Katz did, is also valid for lossy media, for dissipative plates, and also for many other kinds of plates, for magnetic media and for anisotropic materials. I think Filippi will talk about applications for metamaterials next week. And there is a nice, I think, derivation of this formula for lossy plates that explicitly take into account the noise added by the reservoir when we have dissipation, we unavoidably have some coupling to noise. And so they have, well, I see that you don't like very much this, but anyway. So this is a very important result. And it's very tempting to generalize this Professor Katz's idea to to non-planar geometries, right? Because in principle, this idea it's very tempting to generalize it, and we have done that. I mean, the same idea of round trip loops. I mean, that modes that are defined by the fact that we have to reproduce the same field after a round trip can also, in principle, be. This should also hold for when we have something which is not a plane. So in this case, we replace these reflection coefficients, which are numbers, by operators. And these operators, we already talked about this, they describe how the fields are reflected by a non-plane plate, right? So there is, in this case, the k, the momentum parallel to the plane is not conserved anymore, right? Because we have no symmetry of translation along this xy plane. And we also change the polarization. So this operator here, this is the definition of the operator. If you plug into here, we have a new kind of generalization of the Lipschitz form now for non-planar surfaces. We have actually demonstrated that this actually, we have proved this formula, so to speak, in the context of roughness when calculating the effect of the non-planar geometry in a perturbation expansion up to second order in the amplitude of the corrugation. So we have shown that what we get from more standard approaches, like taking the stress tensor and calculating the average value of the stress tensor in vacuum, coincides with what we get from this when we do the expansion up to second order. So we have these kinds of loops with typical of perturbation approach, right? We have two rough interactions because we are calculating to up to second order. So we come with some incident fluctuation here with a given k. We have a rough interaction here. We change k and change polarization too. Then we have to make a round trip and change again in the same mirror. And with this, we can form, I mean, this expression here, when I read it from right to left, I have one rough reflection, propagation back and forth, one specular reflection, then another rough reflection, then another propagation, another specular reflection, another propagation. I can write all the terms I need from these diagrams. Okay.
Since you get basically the same expression derived by this other technique in the surface.
Yeah, I mean, I have two ways of deriving this. Either I take the stress tensor and I calculate how the fields propagate through these two plates with corrugated surface.
You gave in our 2001 paper this interpretation of multiple reflections between the rough surfaces for general hyperbola, so that you get the same thing?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then if you look at this formula and expand this, if I write this as some specular reflection operator, which is not small, plus some small correction, and then I expand the log, I get the same thing. So we were very pleased to have this kind of connection with Lipschitz formula. Of course, this is not a proof of this formula, because, I mean, this formula is more general, of course, but it's a kind of consistency check.
But the second order of correction, can you get for corrugations in both directions?
Yes, exactly. Because we take into account the coupling between different polarizations. We don't need to define a polarization basis where there is no coupling, right? So we don't need to have a direction of a translational symmetry.
Is the coupling important at first order?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
Yeah. I'm trying to get the two kinds of roughness clear in my mind.
Okay.
One of them is that you no longer have a perfect sphere, perfect plane, but okay. You really do have a discrete interface, a step function, and the properties.
These are planes, right? I'm not talking about
planes,
the sphere here.
But the black line is a step function discontinuity.
Oh yeah.
In the response. The other kind of roughness, of course, is that the material interface is extended.
Oh, no, no, no. This is a step function.
Right. So yeah. Can one sort of see how far this carries you toward that? Or is it?
For this kind of smooth interface, yeah. Right? I don't know. I mean.
Because that's what, you know, basically mm-hmm. we are thinking about.
Oh, okay. We have not thought
maybe
about it.
Maybe it works. Maybe there's some way to make it.
Okay. Okay. We can discuss later with more detail. I think this.
Let me ask a similar question from a more mathematical point of view. I can distinguish between two things. I can think of specular reflection from a surface that has a lot of small scale structure, so it's very bumpy.
Okay.
But there's also, and then you could do some statistical analysis to take care of those bumps. Mm-hmm. But you also, and I think this is what you're doing here, you're allowing, for a particular ray, you're allowing what you might call diffractive scattering in all different directions.
Yes.
There is no, even on the microscopic level, there is no specular.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, we change from K to another K. This is the projection on the XY plane. So we are changing this, but not the frequency.
It's not a delta function.
It's not a delta. For the
I'm not sure that actually makes any difference in the end after you average do the.
No. To first order, it does not make any difference because in the case. So the roughness to first order is zero, exactly because of what you said, right? Because we have some kind of it's a stochastic surface, right? But to second order, it does not go to zero.
Okay. There's a limitation to this approach, right? When the scale on which the height profile changes becomes, say, much smaller than the amplitude of the height, then it's actually diverging, right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. I have this in this perturbation. Yes, here I can have this scale, Professor Fulling mentioned, can be much smaller than the separation distance, no problem. So we can beyond PFA. PFA would be to assume that L is much shorter than this typical scale describing this variation here. Yeah. But we have to assume, on the other hand, as you said, that this scale is much larger than the amplitude of propagation, which is another length scale. It's this length scale here must be much smaller than this one. But this one can be much smaller than this one.
Right.
Okay. So, but for roughness, it's quite okay, I think, because the amplitude of corrugation is usually on the order of nanometer. So, in principle, we are confident that this would hold for roughness at least.
And the separation is also allowed to be smaller than the lateral correlation of the. There's simply no connection.
In this case, we would get PFA, right? And then in this case, this is the way people have been using to calculate the roughness correction for this experiment. They have taken this into account by using a PFA-like argument.
Because it's quite interesting, because I think typically for gold or sample, the islands you have are orders of a few hundred of nanometers, in, let's say, 200 nanometer. Which is kind of the distance range where the experiments are so probed.
Okay, then I would say that the PFA is not a good approximation. Yeah. Which means that the roughness correction is larger than what they think it is. That's the point. Well, what we get here is a correction, a roughness correction larger than the PFA correction. So another application we have worked on is this using this formalism is to think we have two corrugated. Now it's a prescribed corrugation, it's not stochastic anymore. And they are rotated with respect to each other. So we are able to calculate the Casimir energy when there is these two prescribed corrugations at a certain angle. Okay, and then we calculate the Casimir energy as a function of this angle and as a function of the lateral displacement. And that means that there is a Casimir torque which tries to align this corrugation line. So we think that this is also an interesting application of geometry. Now, going back to the plane sphere, there has been some interesting results, from the scalar field models by Bordag and by Bulgak, Majewski, and Wiesba. Bordag was able, and I think you also have been able to derive first-order corrections to the PFA. That's what actually what we want to have, right? The next to leading order term. I mean, because PFA is the maybe only. I don't know if you already.
We did just at that time for the first correction at small separation. Mm-hmm. We just looked at the semi-classics. Deviates. The semi-classics agrees with PFA at very short separation.
Okay.
And then, but deviates. That we just calculated, and it agreed with Bordag, the sum of Bordag.
Okay, okay.
That was an interesting
Okay. So Bordag was able to go beyond
Bordag
PFA
really did the calculation and
calculated the next to leading term, right? So recently, Torsten Emig published a paper and for this geometry and a perfect reflecting plane using the method of images. And now I will talk about a formalism which we think is appropriate for describing real materials, both for the metal, both for the sphere and the plate.
Can I make a comment on this?
Yeah.
Because actually, in the 2007 paper, it's also for real methods. It's just that the computation has been done for the perfect method. Right?
So this paper? I mean, I don't see any reflection coefficient for the plane there.
Well, I mean, in the previous paper, you can do it. I mean, it's
For two spheres, right?
I mean,
yeah.
This paper contains actually the interaction of n objects. So, I mean, you can either have a plane, consider this as a reflection plane, and use the method of images, or you take two objects, which is also this. So it's very general.
Yeah, I think it's not very practical, I think, to have this plane sphere from two spheres. It's possible in principle, but I don't think it's... practical way.
No, that's not the way I would do it.
Well, you have formulas which are general in terms of T operators, right? But I'm talking about real calculations, explicit calculations.
Yeah, but so the paper you're referring to is also for perfect metrics, isn't
No, I will show you.
Yeah, but I mean, the one which I've seen published is what gives a result.
No. And the numerical results, yes. But there are some analytical, but the expressions are for finite conductors, and also we discuss some limiting cases for finite conductors, right?
Okay.
I will show you in a minute. Okay. So this is the the scattering formula TGTG, or well, you can call it many different ways. And I have been written with trace of log, right? But it's not very convenient to calculate the log of an operator. It's convenient to make expansions and so on. So we write as a log of a determinant. So we first calculate the determinant of the operator, and then we calculate the log of a number. And then there is a crucial point here, which is I think it's very important here, which is the choice of the basis, right? And of course, for describing the scattering by the sphere, the multiple basis is the more appropriate one. However, and also for the determinant evaluation, because this is a discrete basis. However, for calculating the reflection in the most general case with finite conductivity, I don't think it's easy to do with multiple spherical waves. So it's much easier to calculate with plane waves. That's the main point of our approach. So what we do then, these are the definitions of plane wave basis and multipole basis. L is the corresponds to eigenvalues of L squared, to the angular momentum, and eigenvalues of JZ. And so what we do is we take this operator here, okay, and we want to calculate the matrix elements in this multipole basis, right? So we want to have the matrix element between of this D here with between these two matrix, okay? So what we do is just change the basis to the plane wave basis. So we put an identity here, expand in terms of plane wave basis, and what we get is a change basis matrix here. And since we are now in the plane wave basis, this reflection is trivial, I mean. This is just the Fresnel reflection coefficient, okay? The one we have in the Lifshitz form. And also the propagations are trivial because, the propagation in the plane waves basis is just a phase factor. So we have this. And since we have a plane, we does not change this k, right? as in the corrugated case. So we have the same phase factor here and here. We can put them together. From here, I get the Fresnel reflection coefficient. And what is left here is some matrix element, which I will discuss later. So this has this expression. It's appropriate to describe the case of finite conductors, and has this kind of explanation that goes back to Katz, right? From these loops where we have, we start with a multipole wave here. We decompose into as a linear combination of plane waves. Each plane wave goes, is reflected, gains a factor of a Fresnel reflection coefficient, propagates back, so there are two propagation factors here, and then it's scattered by the sphere. And then I see the scattered field, and I take the component with a given L1, which will be, in general, different from L2. Only the value of M is the same by a rotational symmetry around the z-axis. Okay, so with that, we can show explicitly that it's trivial from this integration here that we have this, this is zero with M1 different from M2. So now, what about these objects here? I mean, this is the Fresnel, as in the Lifshitz formula. What about this one is well-known, too. I mean, it's, this is just spherical harmonics and derivatives of the spherical harmonics. This is just the change of basis from plane waves to multipoles. What about this guy? This is the most important part, right? So what people in classical optics, they what they have is this quantity here. Here is k equal to 0, which means, remember that k is the component parallel to the xy plane. K equal to 0 means a plane wave propagating along the z-axis. Of course, people that do a classical Mie scattering, they can take the z-axis along the propagation direction of the plane wave, right? We can't because we want to consider different propagation directions. But they just take this, and this is just what they call Mie coefficients, right? This is this A and B play the role of scattering amplitudes. For me, scattering. One for we have two because we have two polarizations. One for electric multipoles, and the other ones for electric magnetic multipoles. So this quantity is essentially AL, okay, for P equal to E, and BL for P equal to M. So now we need something more than this, right? We need a plane wave propagating along an arbitrary direction. So what we need is just to rotate this plane wave, right? And when we rotate, we do that with the help of this rotation matrix elements, we get something which is of this form. There is some trivial prefactors here. So it's proportional to the Mie coefficient. Note that this Mie coefficient by spherical symmetry does not depend nor on M, nor on this direction of this plane wave, okay? So it's the same for all the values of theta k. It does not depend on theta k by spherical symmetry. And we got this rotation matrix elements. This one comes from the spin of the photon, right? And for the, all the others, we get similar results. For P, for M here, or TM here, we get similar expressions.
So so the mean coefficients is basically the scattering amplitude.
Yes.
It's a T matrix. So
yeah.
It's identical. And the other thing is the rotation matrix, that's the standard Wigner.
Yeah. As defined by Edmonds. So one thing we can do with this, this is a very complicated expression. I would not dare to write it here. it would be too scary. But one thing you can do with this complicated expression is to derive limiting cases, right? And one very, the simplest limiting case is the limiting case when the sphere is very small. And this is what people in Mie scattering call Rayleigh approximation, right? This is the Rayleigh limit of the Mie scattering. In this case, we can neglect all multipoles but the electric dipole. But look, there is some point here which is, I think is very important to stress. I have to assume not only that the radius is small compared to the wavelength outside, but also compared to the wavelength inside. So there is a tricky question here. I can't In order to have this, I can't have n going to infinity, right? I have to have a finite n. Translating all this into this Casimir context, we know that these wavelengths are the order of the separation distance. So this condition translates to the fact that r must be smaller than the separation distance, of course, but also smaller than l over n. So we can take within the Rayleigh approximation the limit of perfect reflective. Okay. So we have two limits which do not commute. I will discuss that further in a minute. So in this case, we neglect everybody but A1, which is the electric dipole. I also neglect B1, the magnetic dipole. And this is a well-known result for A1. I can come back and calculate this rotation matrix elements for L equal to 1 and M equal to 1 and to 0. There are some explicit expressions, very simple. I can just look at the tables. And what I get is this formula here. So A1 is proportional to the polarizability of the sphere, which is also well known, depends on the epsilon, right? Epsilon minus 1 over epsilon plus 2. And here I can write exactly as in this form, which is very well known, and from the Diego's talk, for instance, he wrote this formula. So this is the general dispersive interaction between a small object and a plate, with taking into account the fact that they are not perfect reflectors. So I have here the reflection coefficients, Fresnel reflection coefficients, because they were there all the time, right? Since the beginning. Okay. Okay. So this is one limiting case. Of course, another limiting case, and here I will make a connection with Thorsten Emig's work, is to take the perfect reflecting limiting case, which is also interesting from a theoretical point of view. What we know, and this is very general, that this limit it should be obtained when the plasma wavelength, remember, is just 2 pi c over the plasma frequency, when this length scale is much smaller than all other length scales, okay? So in this case, it's of course, I get this Fresnel reflection coefficients go to minus 1 and plus 1. This allows me to add analytical over P, and this simplifies enormously, simplifies a lot my complicated expression. This is not surprising because I should, in this limit, make connection with the image method of Thorsten Emig. So, but note that it's here. I can't. I mean, this perfect reflecting limit is not only assuming that n is large, right? This is not enough. This is also connected to what I said before. I must assume that the sphere is larger than the lambda over n. This is physically very reasonable, right? If the sphere is very small, it cannot be a perfect reflector, of course, because lambda p is the scale of penetration inside the metal. If the sphere is so small that this is smaller than lambda p, this is not a perfect reflector. I cannot find a perfect reflector limit in this case, right? So I must assume that R is much larger than the wavelength inside the medium in order to have this perfect reflecting limit. Translating this condition into the Casimir context, that means that lambda p must be the smallest length scale. Must be smaller not only than the separation distance, but also than the radius R.
Actually, there's a counterexample to this, which has been studied for these nanotubes numerically based on a microscopic calculation. People considering there the limit actually where the radius is of the same order as what they call the plasma matrix, or even smaller. And that has been established by some kind of Hartree-Fock calculations.
So yeah, I mean, this, all this facts about the perfect reflecting limit, this is well known in me scattering. I mean, there are books on this.
No, but I'm saying
that discuss very, very carefully how this. I'm not claiming that I am the first. This is in many textbooks.
No, I mean, I'm saying that actually there is another interesting limit where the radius is much smaller than lambda p.
Yeah, sure. This was discussed before. I mean, it's here. Okay? I will discuss this further in the next slide. Okay. So the so what I want to stress exactly is that there is no intersection, no overlap between this limit and the Rayleigh limit. Okay? Because in the Rayleigh limit, I must assume that R is much smaller than everything else.
Yep.
So there is no overlap here. Okay, so in this case, the expressions are much more simple. So in this case, I dare to write them, although they are still scary. But in this case, I'm able to write in terms of this overlap integrals of the rotation matrix. And there is something, I'm writing this here because there is something I would like to point out, which I think is very, very nice, which I find it very beautiful, is this crossover between the two regimes. I mean, all the previous formulas were written in terms of this distance to center lamp scale here. Okay, so in principle, from the start, everything from the start was written in terms of this L here, distance to center. I think this is clear that this must be the proper parameter here, especially from Thorsten Emig's and collaborators' work, right? Because it displaces the coordinate axis to the center of the sphere, so the distance there is the center there. But we know that when we are connecting to the PFA, somehow this distance must be replaced by the distance to surface lamp scale. And it's very beautiful, I think, how this replacement happens. And this is can be seen from here. What happens is that these mi coefficients for large frequencies, the PFA corresponds to L much smaller than R, and the frequencies are of the order of 1 over L, so they correspond to parameter. We call this size parameter in E scattering. Frequency times radius over C. This is a dimensionless parameter, which is essentially the radius divided by the wavelength outside. Okay, so when this parameter is very large, these functions, which are now functions only of this parameter, they grow exponentially like this. Okay, and then when I replace here, or here, or here, or here, what I find in the end, I can combine this exponential with this exponential here, and this is the distance to center. Now I subtract, because this is with minus and this is with plus, I subtract the distance to center, I subtract the radius, and then what shows up, what these expressions behave like, is like this for large frequencies. So I think this is very nice. It's as if we were seeing...
The green stuff is always a conductor. It's basically whether the modes are spreading over the size of it or just seeing the edge.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So somehow, when the sphere is very large, the important lamp scale is the distance to the edge and not anymore the distance to the center.
Right. I mean that I. Basically, this what you call L in this last equation is what also determines the convergence rate. This
might okay, I will discuss in the next slide.
Power law I showed yesterday, right? This exponential.
If you do a semi-classical approximation, mm-hmm. that also is
right.
Okay. All this is, has to do with the semi-classical WKB approximation.
That is also mm-hmm. the scalar case.
Okay. It's the same transition we have in optics, right? From wave optics to ray optics. The same transition we have in from wave mechanics to classical mechanics.
What's particular about a sphere here? If you had a planar slab, you'd have similar kinds of things going on, wouldn't you? If the green stuff were a planar slab also, as it got very close, you would just see the closest part mm-hmm. a little mm-hmm. far away. The sphere is coming to it more slowly, I guess, is it?
I don't see what you mean.
Well, I mean, this limit the
here.
The closest distance mm-hmm. determines the interaction here, mm-hmm. as it does between two planar slabs, right?
Oh, I see what you mean. Ah, okay.
So, mm-hmm. is it
The point is that it's a little bit slower coming to that point of the sphere, but it always reaches that limit. Right?
Yes, yes. I think we always reach the PFA limit at for sufficiently large, sufficient spheres and sufficient.
But, the weight is different. I mean, for slabs, for parallel slabs, you weight for surface. If you see, classically, this is an isolated orbit. For the slabs, it's non-isolated, and it's completely different
Now, I also, of course, derived Torsten Emig's result for small spheres, which correspond. But look, now I'm taking the small sphere limit after taking the perfect reflecting limit. So this corresponds to this range, okay? And then I get Torsten Emig's result.
That has to do with what I said yesterday about taking mu to zero, right?
Yeah, that I didn't get very well because I mean, mu is not zero for a metal, right? It's one.
It depends on what one you call a metal. Sometimes it's maybe useful to make the distinction between a metal and a perfect mirror, right? And so if you have a perfect mirror, that's something where you say there's no electromagnetic field which can go into the material. Then you definitely have to take mu to zero.
But well, no.
That's the wrong boundary condition.
I have a plasma, within the plasma model I can take the perfect reflecting limit by taking lambda pi going.
Let me give you an example maybe. So this equation you have there for that's for a sphere, right? If you want to obtain this from polarizabilities of the sphere, okay? So you write yet on a previous
This is the result I get from the polarizability, right? I mean, which is not the same of this, right?
Okay, that's my point. So, and then if you...
That's my point, too.
But I want to say what the difference is. Can I do this?
Okay, go ahead.
So if you take also the magnetic polarizability of the sphere, which is known in terms of mu, and you set mu to zero, then you get actually exactly the difference and everything matches perfectly.
Okay, but I prefer to think in terms of the plasma model and playing with these different length scales, but I guess it should be somehow equivalent.
I mean, that's
what
actually
saying.
Explained in the paper by Bernier and Duplantier, okay. That you have to take mu to zero.
I think we can consider the perfect reflecting limit by just taking lambda p very small, I think. This is also okay, I guess. So, I mean, this is from in this limit. I mean, lambda p is the smallest length scale, okay? But this has no connection, of course, with the Rayleigh limit. That limit I took in the beginning, considering that the radius was very small from the start, okay? And what happens is if I go back here to this Rayleigh limit and take the, we have this formula for this, right? And take epsilon going to infinity here. So I have some finite result here, which I can plug here, and also took in the perfect reflecting values for this. And I get this formula, which is different, right? Because the difference is that here I have only the electric dipole, and here I have both. I think
right,
that's what you say.
You're missing the magnetic multiple.
Yeah. Here I don't have the magnetic dipole.
And you get the correct. Okay, it's kind of artificial to take mu to zero. But as you said, it's basically a consequence that you have taken before the limit of small k.
Yeah.
If you do it properly in the
I prefer to think in terms of small r. I think it's more physical.
Right, but that's what I'm saying. If you take the Mie coefficient, and without any approximation, you take your dielectric function to infinity, mu drops out, and you get finite numbers as a function of frequency and radius for the Mie coefficients. And if you take them into your approach, you get actually the correct answer, 9 over, what is it, 16?
So isn't this just the difference between the metal and the superconductor?
So
taking mu to zero just means perfect diamagnetism.
Yes, which is a superconductor.
That's what I said, it's a perfect mirror in the sense that you have no fields inside.
So if you go to zero temperature and you, the question is, I guess these are two different physical things.
Right.
So if your metal goes to a superconductor, maybe you want to plug distances you want to take, the mu goes to zero, I don't know.
I think it's also a question of this exchange of limits, because as I said, if you take the mu coefficients and you take just your epsilon to infinity and you don't worry about the magnetic response, the magnetic response drops out automatically as it should be. So everything is consistent, but as soon as you start to do approximations, of course, you have to worry about order of limits.
Right.
I think that's pretty obvious.
Okay. So let me discuss now about this numerical calculation now. So one important point is to know how large the value of L must be in the calculation. Okay. We have to truncate, of course, because we cannot have to. And what is the guiding principle behind this? So, of course, what is critical for us is this limit where we approach the PFA, right? The limit where L is much smaller than R. So this is what people call semi-classical limit, okay? Because the typical wavelengths will be much smaller than R. In this regime, there is this localization principle which holds in this semi-classical regime, which connects, because this is also the transition between wave optics and ray optics, right? Which connects in a very simple way the values of angular momentum to the impact parameters V. So it's a very simple idea. I mean, there is some sophisticated mathematics behind it. But the main idea is very simple. I mean, I replace waves by rays, right? And then I have some impact parameter B here. And the angular momentum is just B times the linear momentum. So in units of H bar, it's just K times B, right? So there is a connection between L and impact parameter. That means that values of L larger than K times R should be negligible, because they correspond to rates that go beyond the edge, right? Okay? So this is slightly more complicated than this. Actually, we have to go a little bit beyond the edge, as I will show in the next slide. But typically, at the first order, say, what we expect is that we have to go up to values of B of the order of R, which means that we have to go to values of L. The maximum value of L should scale like this. And this we have verified in our numerical calculation. Okay. That means that to approach the PFA, of course, it should be hard from a numerical point of view, because the PFA limit is when this parameter is very large. So we have to add many multiples. So there is a lot of discussion on this in this nice book, which I like, from my colleague.
There's some nice extension of this. If you don't have perfect metals, you have a dielectric or something.
This holds for dielectric. This is general.
It has to be a compact scattering region. I mean, if it's, of course, an infinite extended potential, this argument wouldn't avoid. You have to have a compact region, and then it just means semi-classically nothing scatters, right? I mean, that's just the term in terms of maximum angular momentum.
Wouldn't you say that nothing scatters if it's a very dilute medium? So
no, if it's compact.
Yes.
Then if the impact parameter is larger than the radius where it sits, it will not scatter semi-classically. That's just this trivial fact. Mm-hmm. And you see it in the Bessel function or Hankel functions, just they change the behavior around that area.
Okay.
But you get a small correction. I mean,
Okay.
That's well known.
There was a question that Adrian was asking yesterday, that if you go rather than perfect metals to something that is like a dielectric or at finite temperature, would we have to work harder or less?
It would not change.
Yeah, I mean, I think this kind of argument is pretty general, I think. Yeah.
I always hope less.
This would not, the geometry would be the same for finite temperature or so it would not change.
Yeah, this is actually well known by people who do Mie scattering, with which we really have dielectric spheres. And one of the applications is to understand scattering of light by clouds, right? So the spheres of water, right. And they are right in this range of parameters where the size parameter is very large. They are right in the semi-classical approximation because the droplets are much larger than the visible light wavelength. So there is a lot of work on this, and this has many important applications, even for climate models, right? They need to know, for instance, how much light is absorbed by clouds. And so they have to go back to this kind of scattering.
Yeah.
Can I ask Maran's question in my my way? Where does the softness of the potential comes in the end? I mean, if okay, maybe that gives you a scale of the angular momentum that contributes, but when the...
I think I can... I mean, we have to may think in terms of the effective potential, right? We have to add the centrifugal barrier, right? So we have something like this. Okay? For n larger than 1, we have some kind of... So as I will show in the next slide, what happens then is if L is much big, we just scatter, you just see the centrifugal barrier, you don't see the scatter itself, okay? So this means that there is no contribution. It's like it doesn't see the potential inside. So it's something like, it shows that there are some nice, interesting things here, which are the mid resonances, which I will show in the next slide. So this is a typical mis scattering calculation I took from one of my papers. I won't discuss the context of this. This is a component of the optical force in optical tweezers. It's not really very, I think it's out of context to discuss this here. But what I want to discuss is the question of convergence with L, the angular momentum. This is L, and this is a partial wave sum. I have this quantity here is a partial wave, is a sum over L, right? And I am plotting the result when I truncate at a given L, which is given here, okay? So you see that typically what we have is something which is kind of erratic, right? And a typical situation is this green situation here. This is for this wavelength of light, right? And this is the radius of the sphere. So it's rather, I would say it's rather difficult to extrapolate, to guess the final value without reaching the final convergence, right? If I stop here, for instance, I can never guess what is the final value. If I stop here or here, I really have to see. I really have to reach convergence in order to know the right value, the correct value. Okay. So
E over 2, something like this. You multiply the impact parameter by E over 2. That's rule of thumb.
So look, the size parameter here for this value is 48, right? So it's more or less around here that we get convergence, right? For values larger than this, it's nothing changes. But you see, if I choose another wavelength which is very close to this one, look what happens. This red one here, there is a jump, okay? And this is because I hit a mid resonance. I choose one resonance frequency of this potential.
That's
well
for sphere and.
This is me scattering. I have.
Is it what do you make assumptions to make about the material? Right.
This is a polyestidene. How do you say this in English? Polyestidene a sphere in water. Okay.
Okay, so
and this is the context here is optical tweezers. We have a sphere which is have a refractive index is slightly larger than the surrounding fluid.
Okay, so that you see this behavior is also probably partly due to the material properties, right?
No, this is more a topological resonance. This is mere resonances which are not related really to the epsilon, but. Really to the geometry.
Yeah, they're equivalent to the whispering modes.
Yes, yeah. They are related, exactly, yes, exactly.
So what would you see, how would the curves look like if you would do it, say, for perfect conductors?
Oh, no. These mere resonances are only for dielectric media,
right.
With indexes larger, because it's actually this picture that Francesco is, this is related to total internal reflection. We circulate inside the sphere.
But I'm asking this because of the question Adrian asked. I mean, it's kind of, so you would probably because of that expect a different convergence with this angular momentum cutoff for the electric sphere as opposed to...
Okay, but there is, let me just, otherwise I would be dishonest. Let me just say something which is very important here in this context. These mu resonances, they are close to the real axis, right? But in our calculation, we are integrating over the imaginary axis. That's why I put this oof here, which means that it's not so bad. I mean, if we had on our integration these resonances, we would be would be much harder to do the calculation.
But sorry, I mean, the region where it stabilizes is basically the same again, right?
Yeah, it's slightly. I mean, there is this slight contribution of above edge. If I take a look here, I see that slightly above that condition, there are rays which are slightly above the edge. These are the rays that contribute to the mean resonance.
It depends on how many digits you want. If you want a reasonable number of digits, you go to this region that's stabilized. When it's stabilized also with mu resonance, it doesn't matter.
I didn't see you. I mean, this is a huge jump, right?
Yeah, but it's stable.
I mean, look, for this point here, it have already...
I'm worried about, do I get any change any longer if I go to a high angular momentum? And apparently I don't.
Look, here and here... I have here. On. I have a large contribution.
A little bit to the left. I mean, yeah, and here L equals 50 or 55.
Slightly.
This is from American program.
No, look, it's slightly above edge. Okay, it's not a lot above edge. And this is, I mean, you can also calculate this analytically and show that you have to take into account this above edge.
Yeah, but I think you anyhow go to a region where it's stable, and when you use criteria that...
what this code probably shows, I think, is that you have to be careful and not somehow interpret if you have some kind of tendency that you say, you already see the final tendency. So you really have to make sure that you enter the plateau.
Yeah, that's my point. Yeah, exactly.
I think that's all. But that you, I mean, 50 or 60 is not a big number for the moment.
That's my point. Yeah.
I have just a simple question, a technical question. The mu resonances, I'm not really sure, but are they slightly below the real axis or above the real axis?
It depends on the definition of Fourier transform, but they have some width, right? So the imaginary value is the width of the resonance. Right? you are worried about the weak rotation, maybe.
Things like this, yes. So is it usually below, though?
Yeah, I think you can do the weak rotation.
In case space is below, and then in space is
below. I see your point. So
I'm trying very hard to remember the right words from an optics course because I've never what's that regime when the differences in the indices of refraction are small and you can use a quasi Rayleigh limit? What is that? There's a two guys hyphenated name here. And there's an
error. Evaldosin.
Sorry?
Evaldosin? You sum over dipoles, right? You have, instead of using macroscopic equations, you sum the field of the dipoles.
Something
and the median is very fine.
There's an analog, right, in Van der Waals calculations.
Yeah, sure.
That the coefficient then is whatever you do for all the hard work in the spectrum. But the geometry dependence suddenly looks very simple. It looks like a pairwise summation again, because you have no multiple scattering.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Is this there?
No, here, this calculation was not for a rarefied median. I mean, it's a median with a refraction index of 1.5 or 6.
It's not the difference that's counting, yeah?
Yeah. And okay, the relative refractive index is not so close to 1 either. It's about 1.2. So.
Because there's this massive act of forgiveness that occurs when you have that. And that simplifies the course. But that's not what you're talking about here yet.
No. Okay. So, So let me show you my numerical results, which are only for perfect reflectors. So how I will show you is something which is, it's a confirmation of Thorsten Emig's result somehow. I'll just give you some details, and then I'm over. So I'm plotting here the ratio between the exact between quotes Casimir energy. I mean, within this model of perfect reflectors and the PFA value. Okay, so this is this whole is equal to 1 in the PFA limit. Okay, and its value will quantify how bad the PFA is, right? So we always find values of rho smaller than 1. Okay, so the PFA overestimates the effect. And so this is the plot with different values of maximum angular momentum. So we are able to go reliably to this value of, and I'm going to show you a few fits. So this first fit, it's kind of misleading, because actually in this region we are not so good anymore. There is already a slight bending of the curve due to this truncation. So our problem is we want to be as close as possible to the PFA, I mean to this origin here. But on the other hand, this is costly from the numerical point of view. So it's a kind of a compromise. It's like haute cuisine. We have to make the right. So this is another. So all these are numerical values, right? That we, and this is L over R is the same of here, and this is rho. And so what I want to tell you is that we have made many fittings like that with different ranges. And the average is exactly what you have obtained.
Same number, right?
Which is nice, which is quite surprising because it's such a big calculation. I mean, not surprising, I'm sorry, but it's quite nice because it's such a big calculation that in the end we find the same thing. So this is rather nice. Yeah, you are right.
Which means basically that we both probably got into the right short distance regime.
No, it's perfect, perfect.
Everything here now is perfect. I'm sorry, I forgot to mention.
Perfect conductors.
Yeah.
It's only the difference between two parallel plates and the parallel plate and sphere. And it's at the edge. I mean, the Decker. Well, I mean, he has not perfect.
All right, right. Good question. Yeah.
But it's
mm-hmm. Yeah. What?
Basically, you are even above. Well, mm-hmm. in above his error bar slightly. But
yeah. I think you asked it yesterday, right? There is a small calculation I have to do in order to compare with Decker, because this is just the energy and I have to...
You divide by 3.
Okay, so what happened is that I think we are very on the threshold, right?
Yeah.
Sorry, I mean...
But you have to remember that this is for perfect reflectors, so we can't be... Yeah. And in the range of distances used by Decker, it's where the perfect reflecting limit model is very bad. So
sorry, but the experiments are done at 10 minus 3 L over R, huh?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm very far from this. Yeah, you're right. And I think Torsten 2 is...
No, but the coefficient is the same.
I'm sorry.
I mean, this is...
Yeah.
He tests the coefficient, I mean, the deviation.
Yeah, but I think somehow he has a point, because, I mean, I would guess that this just goes on like this, but I cannot prove until now, right?
It's very plausible. I mean,
it's very plausible.
Kind of, you have the lowest order correction, which is this 0.4.
Yes. Okay.
So what you say is you go now close enough to already probe only the first order correction.
Yeah.
So the closer you go, doesn't matter. I mean,
No, you have even a second order correction calculated, right? Yeah. I mean, and so. You can even check whether the second order correction is unimportant.
Yeah. That's actually the reason I looked at the quadratic correction. So that's not important if you go to subgroups. Basically, you have to take into account only the linear.
Yeah, I mean, for the second, I agree with you, it's not very important. And I'm not able to be sure about it because it fluctuates enormously from one fit to the other. So. I cannot say anything about this. Okay. But it doesn't matter, really, I think. I agree.
So what L did you go here for?
27.
Well, it's funny. I mean, why do you go only to that small number? I mean, you could as well go to 50. I mean, it limits you. I mean, I'm limited because of the Clebsch-Gordan coefficients. Mm-hmm. What limits you?
Okay, so...
I mean, if you really are honest about the numerics, I mean, what is making you... So Bessel functions that...
okay, so what you have to keep... I mean, there's a difference between electromagnetism and scalar field, of course, yeah. which gives you makes your matrix somewhat larger, because you have your polarizations...
Yeah. But the matrix together. Size is not the problem.
I agree, but if you compute the determinant and then you have to integrate it over frequency, you have to make this very accurate.
The internal calculation is no problem whatsoever. I mean, you go to the upper triangle form and
right,
bang where you have
it. LU decomposition, right. Yeah, in principle you can go to...
No, but what is really, honestly, your limitation? I mean, if you... I say it's, in my case, the Clifgordons, because I run out of precise Clifgordons at some stage. And I don't trust them anymore. I see things go
in my case, I have not a sufficiently good program to calculate this for large L's.
Yeah.
And then I start to get numerical error.
I haven't
error.
Seen any problems with the Clifgordon. What I see is, and that's probably not very important because... Okay, so what I see if I take for the interval, I have to integrate from zero frequency to infinity. However, it decays exponentially, the integrand, so you can cut it off at some frequency. At small frequencies, it goes to zero, so you can cut it off basically at some very small frequency. Of course, you have to make sure that you don't cut off too much so that you within your error bars. If you What I've seen is if you go to extremely small frequencies, you get an instability coming from the Bessel functions, actually. Because you have some which diverge and some which actually converge at zero frequency, and that compensates to give you a finite number.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, of course, hard to establish numerically.
Yeah, my problem as well is also that...
If you accept actually a small error bar,
mm-hmm.
and cut off at a somewhat larger frequency, then you're fine and you can increase actually the order of L where you cut off. So therefore, it's kind of, you have to decide if you accept a small error in the integral, you can go to higher L and see how it converges, but then you have to keep in mind that there is a small error, which you can easily estimate, right? Because you know the interval you've cut off, you've left out in your integration, say from 0 to 10 to the minus 4 or so, and you know what the integrand is at 10 to the minus 4 is in frequency or dimensionless frequency. You have a precise estimate of what the error is. So you can do that. But, okay. I think as soon as the experiments are in this regime and there's actually a need to do the calculation, one can do it. But,
yeah, it's rather tricky. We can
discuss later. Yeah, I could best function.
I think I just want to show.
That's my limitation.
I think it's rather late.
I think I stopped at a cutoff of about 38.
Yeah, it was going to somehow 40, 50, below 50.
And I think the Bessel function stuff is even more pronounced in the electromagnetic case, because there you have actually more cancellations going on than on the scale.
So just to finish, I want to stress that our computation principle allows for the case of real methods, but we still don't have the numerical result for real methods, unfortunately, because it's really more, it's even trickier with real methods, of course, because it gets more complicated. But we are working on this, and I hope we will have results very soon. And but I'm rather skeptical about going to L over R of the order of 10 to the minus 3. But maybe we can try to do some calculation like Bohdak did for the scalar case. I don't know. So that's what we are.
That would be the optimal thing to do. But I wouldn't be so pessimistic about this 10 to the minus 3 because, mm-hmm. okay, it's always kind of an assumption that you say it's linear correction.
Mm-hmm.
But if your data, if you go to the separations, you study it and you see a linear behavior, you can extract the linear coefficient quite well. And as you said, it's very plausible that it's just the linear correction which holds down to contact, basically.
Yeah, that's possible. Yeah.
Well, you should, as you have done, you should also extract the next correction.
Yeah.
As to be on the safe side.
Yeah.
Can you, I mean, for electrostatics, you can calculate the PFA and the full equation for this geometry. And then you can get an idea of how off you are.
Okay.
For example, I mean, I've seen now in my experiment that I do see I have a 200 micron sphere.
Right.
And I measure up to, let's say, 1 micron.
Okay.
And closer. Mm-hmm. And I do have CPF deviations from the
for the capacitance.
For the electrostatic force.
Okay. Which means the formula for the capacitance of these planes here.
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And those are all of the order of a few percent.
Okay.
The deviation at 1 micron. What would be now more or less the deviation? I mean, if you compare the deviation in the Casimir between PFA and the real, and if you compare it to the electrostatic case, how would that look like?
I don't see if I understood your question.
I want to see if
Casimir, if the PFA in Casimir is much worse than the PFA in electrostatics,
I see.
Idea of if it's doable with an experiment to.
I see. Good point. Yeah. I don't know. I have to check that comparison in the electrostatic.
I think there's no real. As the Simic classics gives you a completely different answer, right? I mean, factor 8, small answer. So you have no.
I'm not too worried about the factor 8. I'm more worried about the factor 1,000, because then you can never see it. I mean, it's more. I mean, we're in the order of. Can we go in the order of a few percent, or are these?
When you try semi-classical things, I mean, if you orders of magnitudes, well, it's even an order of magnitude difference, right? In factor 8.
Yeah, you mean this factor of 8 here, right? It's
eight,
what you mean.
Yeah.
But I think that the real problem is to know if it's possible to do experiments and see these deviations from PFAs, to know if it's practical to have the smaller sphere and larger distance and still be able to measure some force, right? I don't know if this is possible.
Approximately linear in the radius.
Yeah, so maybe you can estimate this, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I think that is something one should do to understand.
Right.
So you guys basically, I mean, if you ask for the force between the electrostatic force between a plane and a sphere, I think that's basically the calculation which is much simpler than this one.
Mm-hmm.
Because what you take is basically, of course, you need not just the capacitance, but also higher order multipole moments, but you do actually multipole expansion in statics.
Dynamics. I can do it.
It's basically you take the zero frequency limit of your Mie coefficients, and that should correspond to the electrostatics limit, and then it is basically the same calculation, and you don't have to do actually the frequency integral. So I think that should give you the electrostatic force. I mean, that's a calculation of probably would be easy to see what's the correction between the proximity and proximity.
Okay, but there is known for electrostatics. There is an equation. That gives you the
Okay. It's exact, right?
It's exact equation by the methods of images.
Like yes. Because it's much simpler.
But there you can take up, I mean, up to 10 million terms easily in the summation.
Yeah, as I said, it's much simpler.
Yeah.
Boring but practical.
Okay, I think I'm done.
Thank you.
Stay in this room right here. Yeah.